Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Where Do I Begin podcast. Today we are joined by a very special guest, one of my favorite people, and we are going to be talking about generational wealth. If you're new here, I am your host. My name is Lola. And the reason why I've brought our guest on today is because the conversation around generational wealth is something that him and I have spoken about. And I thought it would be great to have him on the podcast, you know, to expand the conversation a little bit. And hopefully it's something we can all benefit from. So without further ado, special guest, would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm feeling very special. thanks for that build up. I'm Samuel Luko. I am a manager at PwC. My job title is very complicated, so I'm not going to bore you guys with the complicated version. But like in a nutshell, I'm a banking risk and controls expert, I would say. So I basically support banks just refining their controls to make sure they stay out of trouble and maximize their operations. I'm not a wealth management expert, but I am quite opinionated and have strong views on some of the angles that we're going to talk about today. So it is really an honor to be invited on. I'm really excited, looking forward to the conversation. And I'm very passionate about the Black community as well. So outside of my day job, I do a lot to support our community, like young people, people of all ages, really. I am the chair of the Black Network at PwC. So through that, I'm just able to, you know, make an impact and really just try and support our community and bring a commercial lens to good inclusion of that Black community. So yeah, that's a little intro to myself.
Great. Little bit, guys. I hope you realise that the resume is long. Very expensive.
Oh, Lala, please.
But he's trying to be humble today, so...
That's not long.
I won't put it in black, you know? Anyway, before we get into today's conversation, we're going to play a little game. How do you feel about games?
Oh, I like games, you know. Let's play games.
Sure.
Yeah, let's play a game.
Cool. So we're going to play Would You Rather... but we're going to play it slightly differently. Obviously, I will ask the question. You will tell me which one you would rather do or prefer. And then I also want you to guess what you think the most popular answer was.
Okay, cool.
Okay, does that make sense?
I feel like I'm being examined here, but let's do it.
Not at all. It's fine.
Cool. Let's go for it.
Okay, cool. So the first question is, would you rather end student loan debt forever or end credit card debt forever?
End student loan debt forever.
You don't have to say why, but which one do you think is like the most popular answer?
I think the credit card one is probably the most popular because most people probably have more credit card debt than student loan, I reckon.
You ready for the answer?
I'm ready for the answer.
I feel like I need a drum roll here, but... So, your first answer was actually correct.
Okay.
And that also actually was the most popular answer. So, not the credit card debt. Most people actually wanted student loan debt to be ended forever. But I'm going to give you some bail. These questions were answered in America, so it was an American survey, and you know how they feel about student loans over there. The financial structure for their student loans is a bit different to what we have in the UK, so it kind of makes
sense.
I'll still give you a point, you know. I'll give you a point there.
You allow me.
Cool. So the second question is, would you rather win the lottery and lose all your friends or lose all your money but find your soulmate? I know this one is a hard one for you because you got a lot of friends in this show. So,
oh my days. So what was the second one? Would I rather be broke and have loads of friends?
Rather win the lottery and lose all your friends, or lose all your money and find your soulmate?
Oh, right. I'm a softie at heart, you know, so I'm going to go for the latter.
The soulmate. I'm surprised. Yeah. I thought maybe the friends might win this one.
Nah, man. I'm a
softie. You know how you guys are with your boys?
Underneath it all, we're all softies, man.
Fair enough. I hear that. So what do you think the most popular answer was?
Money. Everyone's trying to get their bag up. Yeah, I reckon.
It's the opposite.
Really?
People actually said they would rather lose all their money but find their soulmate.
I feel like you are the money one, though, because the way you reacted, boy.
What do you mean?
you said really with your chest, like, sound what you did.
I was surprised, you know, by your response. I guess that's what it was. But
what's your answer for that one?
Wow. So now we're putting me in the hot seat.
I told you, listen, it's a conversation.
It's a tough one, but I think I'll go for the soulmate as well, to be honest.
Mm.
Because I feel like I'm a very resourceful individual. So I feel like I'll always find ways to make money, regardless.
I hear it.
In fairness, though, it was like a 59%, 41% tie. So 59% of people said they'd rather lose all their money and find their soulmate. And then 41% said, they'd rather win the lottery and lose all their friends.
So it's not like a 90-10 still.
No. It was neck and neck. Neck and neck. Okay. Okay, the next one. We've still got a few more to go. Would you rather have a job you really hate but with a high salary? Or have a job you really love with a below average salary?
The latter. So, job I really love with a below average salary.
Okay. I'm beginning, if I can speak the English, to notice a theme here.
You're beginning to see a bit of my character that people don't really see.
Yeah. I'm noticing. What do you think the most popular answer was for this one?
I've been wrong on all my guesses so far on what they think. So, I still think that people would rather have money. So I'm going to go for the rubbish job and high money.
I'm afraid I'm wrong again.
Okay, so I'm going to start guessing the opposite to what I think people think. So people actually think like me then. Cool.
You know what it is? I feel like it might just be that UK-US thing. It's either that or the people that completed this survey were not telling the truth. Those are the only two options. But yeah, 56% of people said they would prefer to have a job that they love with a below average salary than a job that they hate with a high salary. So
that's good. That's good for them.
Yeah. I think I'll be happy to do both, but the first one only for a short period of time, because my peace of mind is very important. So
listen, it's a big priority for me, boy.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, I think we have maybe like two more and then we'll be done. So the next question is, would you rather spend $1 million on travel or spend $1 million on clothes? We see you dripping on the gram, so tell us.
Oh my God, we are not doing that.
Tell us the truth, Sam.
That's a good question, actually. It's not a good question. $1 million on travel.
Don't think about it actually in terms of the million. Just think, which one would you rather spend your money on, traveling or clothes?
Right.
Maybe that makes it easier.
Okay, that does make it easier, but it's still traveling. So traveling is not something I did much growing up, to be honest. So I feel like my last year of my 20s now, and definitely my 30s, I'm going to try and make up for that. So, yeah, my mentality now is travel, clothes. Not that deep, man. I'm tall anyway, so I'd have to go to the tall section. I know everything has the tall section. So
That's why they're paying you what they're paying you. You can afford to.
Lola, you're on joke today still. Don't worry, I'll get you back. I'll get you back. But nah, let's go for travel.
Travel, okay. And what do you think the most popular answer was for this one?
Travel. They agree with me.
And you're actually right. You're right.
Yeah, no, you can't beat the experience of a travel, right?
Like, oh yeah, for sure.
Make memories and stuff.
Yeah, and you learn a lot as well, actually, from traveling. So you learn about 100%. Yourself, you learn about other people, other cultures. So yeah, I'm definitely down for traveling as well. Okay, so the final question in our game is: would you rather? Okay. This one's actually a little bit interesting. Would you rather go back in time to fix your biggest money mistake or look into the future to find out where you end up? This one is a little deep.
Ooh, that one is very deep.
Yeah. You don't have to share what the biggest money mistake is, but if you want to and you feel like it would be interesting, by all means, the floor is yours.
All right, after the pod, I'll share that one.
Cool.
I don't like the future one just from the perspective of, I don't really like the knowing where I end up. I kind of like the whole being able to change my future.
Right.
Like through the actions I do now kind of thing, or through what I've done in the past. So I'll go for the past one. And I would say people would have said the past one as well.
Well, you're not wrong, but I'm going to make it a little bit harder for you now. So what percentage out of 100%, what percentage of people do you think went with your answer?
Okay, so I'm not wrong. So more people said past. And they've all been quite close, so I'd say 55.
You're pretty close as well. It's actually 50-50, strangely
enough.
Is it? Yeah.
Oh, I'm not wrong.
You're not wrong as well. What's 50-50? Okay. I think maybe some people probably like taking risks that are not calculated risks. Because that's how I sort of see the last one, look into the future to find out where you end up. I'm not sure how I feel about that as well.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Yeah.
Okay. That was fun.
Well, I'm glad you found it fun. And the last question, they almost dampened the mood. So moving swiftly along. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, guys, today we're going to be talking about generational wealth. And one of my favorite quotes, actually, around generational wealth is a quote by Paul Killick. And he basically said, wealth is about freedom. And the financial choices we make today ultimately will determine the quality of life we live in the future. Now, with that quote, I was able to draw, I guess, it triggered a memory, actually, let's put it that way. It triggered a memory when I was growing up, because growing up, I was actually told getting your education will give you your freedom, as opposed to, you know, getting money will give you your freedom. So I thought that was really interesting. And the reason why I guess the old generation told me that was because they believe that, you know, with your education, once you have it, essentially, you know, no one can take it from you. With your education, it will give you a higher chance of, you know, financial stability and security, as well as give you an opportunity to be self-dependent. So in line with that theme, my question to you, Sam, is if you were actually in charge of our educational system, what would you change and implement to teach the next generation about money? Do you think it's necessary? Do you think they're doing enough or they're not doing enough? Like,
I just think that it needs to be more of a core subject. Money management, when we talk about budgeting and investing and things like the stock market and stuff like that, that needs to be ingrained in students from a younger age, I think. Most teenagers get their first job like in their teens. Well, most people get their first job in their teens. So with that in mind, you've now got income coming in, and you, in some cases, you've got complete freedom over what you do with your income. So, you know, if you haven't necessarily had that baseline in the schooling system, then you could be blowing it from early and then developing habits that follow you into adulthood, if you know what I mean. So I think that there's a lot of positive, from what I've heard anyway, because I went to a state school, but people that I know that went to a private school have had a lot of early grooming in financial literacy compared to, you know, what I had and what, you know, people around me that went to similar schools also had. So if I had that power, I would definitely level the playing fields there as well, in terms of I would make it more uniform, the, you know, national curriculum that is taught in every school should be either we say that private schools have the best practice and then we implement that across the board so everyone has a fair access to, you know, the same baseline and the same amount of financial literacy from a young age. And if I have that power, I put all the money that is needed into that to make sure we get, you know, the right upskilling for the teachers and the right teachers on board, the right resources, the right, you know, if you, you know, we're in the season of COVID and whatnot at the moment, or we're coming out of it. So we're making sure that students all have the right access to internet at home and everything that they need, sort of thing. So I am investing in making sure that that playing field is as level as possible and is in line probably with what those private schools have. I would also, again, target students from an early age. So I know in year two, they're doing a lot of cognitive sort of examinations and being assessed on that. So, you know, I'll tailor some of those conversations to the age of the kids. But right from that age, I'll be having, you know, quizzes around financial literacy, helping them to understand the value of needs versus wants. I'll be training the parents as well where I can, you know, parents evening, I'll make more use of them and, well, in a condescending way, but again, just level the playing field as much as possible. Some parents haven't necessarily had the time to upskill themselves in financial literacy, but we always say that charity begins at home. So if you could do something with the parents as well, so that they're supplementing what happens at school at home, then that's also a positive for me.
Wow, that was a really good answer. I don't even have anything to counter that. You actually raised some really, really good points. And I just wanted to follow up on one of them, the one you mentioned about the people that you know that went to private school having, I guess, the benefit of being groomed or given some level of financial literacy that students that went to state schools don't have. Would you say they come from quite well-off families, or do they get in by scholarships? Or
yeah, no, it's a good question. I actually know a few that got in by scholarships, but the vast majority of the black people that I know that went to private school either had, you know, fairly decent, a family with fairly decent, you know, wealth, or a family that put all of their money into their kids' education. Do you know what I mean? Because that in itself is an investment. And I know we're going to talk about generational wealth a little bit later in terms of how do you maintain it and build it. But, you know, investing in your children's education can just really bring some of those intangible benefits that will keep the knowledge flowing from generation to generation. So I think some parents have realized that from an early age, and any money that they got from any job they were doing, however hard it was, however low it was. One thing that I would say Africans, some Africans are really good at doing is saving, maybe not so much investing, but really good at saving for a rainy day. And some of those put a lot of that into their children's education. So they were able to go to private school and get the benefits of that.
Okay. The reason why I actually asked that question was when I was preparing for this, I was trying to find out if there was like a number when it comes to like how long the generational wealth lasts for. And the answer to this question was rather surprising. And what I found online was that a staggering 70% of wealthy families basically lose their wealth by the next generation. With 90% losing it the generation after that. And they also went on to say that obviously for you to be able to maintain generational wealth, you need to be financially savvy. But something that's also important to note is that not all rich parents are passing along that financial education to their children. So that's why I asked earlier, like, would you say those people that went to private schools, you know, do they come from rich families or was it like a scholarship thing? Because I feel like sometimes if that mentality is missing at home, sometimes it doesn't matter what the school does.
It's true.
You know, it's, we still see the impact essentially in society. But
that's why that point about new money and old money is so interesting. Like, you see so many footballers or music artists or even people win lotteries and stuff. And then the money's just gone even before they've got a chance to get to the next generation, because that intangible, I think the intangibles, like such as financial education, values, habits, I think that is more important for maintaining generational wealth than the actual financial assets, like the money and the property and stuff like that. Because like you said, that can go in a flash. But if you've got the mentality for knowing how to keep it and how to pass it on, and then you pass that on to your kids, and that's a family tradition, then that's when you start to see some of that staying for a long time in your name.
Totally, totally agree. So my next question for you, it's a bit interesting, but the question is basically, how do you start shifting your mindset towards giving when you don't have anything? Now, the reason why I ask this is because when you listen to a lot of talks or motivational speeches around, you know, wealth, one of the things that they say is one of the, I guess, pillars of building wealth is your ability to also be generous, which I think, funny enough, ties in with a verse in the Bible in Proverbs that basically says, a generous person will prosper. Whoever refreshes others will be refreshed. So it's almost like when you're being generous and when you have a given nature, like, it comes back to you, kind of thing. So I just wanted to know, like, what your thoughts are around, you know, shifting your mindset towards still being a giver, even if you don't feel like you have a lot to give, or if generosity doesn't come to you as like a natural thing. Like, how can you be a bit more intentional about being a giver?
I would say the first thing to do is just define a personal purpose. So almost understanding your why. And this even goes beyond you. This goes before you thinking about why you're giving someone money. Just understand, not necessarily from a religious perspective. I'm a Christian, so for me it would be religious. But even if you're not religious, everyone has a personal purpose for why they do what they do. And that drives their mission, their values, and all of that. So define your personal purpose. And within any purpose, giving can be sort of an associate of that. Do you know what I mean? If your purpose is to support the youth, help people, or, you know, come up with a really cool technology, you can always find an angle within that for giving. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it can always sort of relate. So for me, it's understanding that why, and not really deterring for it, not necessarily wanting anything back from it as well. So I know you just mentioned about, you know, so a wealthy person needs to get into that mode of giving and understanding that it will come back. But even if it doesn't come back, once you've got that purpose, then you understand that you're getting fulfillment from that giving. And then, you know, that will almost shift your mindset to feeling like I've done what I need to do and I'll go on to the next thing, or whatever happens, sort of thing. That's my perspective anyway.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that as well. I think something that's also, I guess, interesting about the whole giving thing is sometimes, you know, you giving doesn't necessarily have to be financial. It could be your time as well. It could be sharing knowledge, which is something that I know is lacking in our community when it comes to this whole wealth conversation. There are lots of information out there, but there are also lots of misinformation. So I know, like, that was one of my key goals, you know, with this podcast. It's sort of my way of giving back to the community. You know, some of the things that I know now are things that I paid to go to uni to study. And I'm out here giving it for free. I'm nearby always coaching people for free. And sometimes people don't necessarily, like, you know, embrace the work that you're, you know, putting in to be like, look, I'm trying to put you on game here. And you often see people, you know, fall for the hype of this, I guess, these investment gurus. And some of them know what they're talking about, but others, I just look
very few.
Yeah, like, it's just what we're doing.
Listen, it's crazy. But that's such a good point about non-financial giving. That's something that I think, again, is a real bedrock to, you know, advancing our community to the next stage. It's some of those intangible gains that's where we really need to be.
And sometimes I feel like even with financial giving, it can be a hindrance for some people. Because some people can really get used to you, like, just giving them stuff financially that they now no longer have the motivation to, you know, go out and get it themselves or, you know, work hard. And I feel like people can easily fall into the mentality of, well, this person will give me, so it's okay for me to just receive in the average, essentially. You know, that drive could potentially be missing. So whilst I think, you know, financial giving is definitely something we should do, I also feel like we shouldn't do it to a point where people become so dependent on that they don't go out and, you know, do things for themselves as well.
And you see it with, sorry, I know we're pushed for time, but I just completely agree. Like, you see it with angel investing and things like Dragon's Den. Like, the reason they're able to command such a high percentage of someone's entire business that they put all their money and their IP into is because they're not just giving them money and saying, go away. They're bringing their expertise. They're bringing their connections. They're bringing their experience. And that, again, is an extremely important thing to have on board. It really just takes you that next level than if I just gave you X number of money. It's not as valuable.
Totally agree. So on to my next question. Another interesting one. So being that the age of 30 is a magic number, you know, when society sort of expects us. Any 30-year-olds in the house? I don't know what you're talking
about.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Is that what I'm telling ourselves?
Yes, I am still 25. What do you think?
Me too, I'm a baby boy, please.
But so being that the age of 30 essentially is the magic number where, or the magic age, where society expects us to have everything together, particularly in the areas of career and finance, what three things would you do financially, knowing what you know now as far as, you know, financial literacy is concerned? So if you look back a decade ago and look at, you know, maybe your spending habits, for example, or, you know, just your relationship with money in general, what three things would you do now, having the benefit of hindsight, basically?
I feel like there's a few obvious ones, but I'll try and be not obvious. I mean, an obvious one that I would definitely do is I'd spend more time researching the stock market and understanding the stock market from an earlier age. A lot of things, it's never too late. You could always start now, but I always think the earlier you start, the better. Because then, you know, time value of money, and if you had put stuff down then and you take a look at how much it's worth now, you know, it can make a big difference. So if I understood the stock market from an earlier age and got into investing as soon as I started working, as opposed to just that mentality of just trying to save and not always being successful, then yeah, I think I'd be much better off financially. An unusual one, I'd go into tech, so I would study something like computer science, because I just feel like tech is the gateway to wealth for the Black community. I feel like that's where, I feel like that's where we all need to be. And I think the beauty of tech as well is that you can find tech in everything. And I think people don't really realize that as well. Like anything you're doing now, there's tech, there's a tech to be found in it that you can get involved in. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whether that's manufacturing, financial services, anything, there's tech there. So I would like have loved to understand sort of those technical bits a bit more, so the cloud and stuff like that, because now I do some stuff with tech as part of my day job, but it's more from the consulting side, which is completely fine. But it would be amazing to understand that as well. And again, I really encourage everyone, especially young people, to at least have an understanding of tech, because I really think that's just where the future is. And yeah, that's where our pathway to wealth creation exists, in my opinion. And a random one, I'll get on the council flat waiting list from when I, as soon as I could. So I would apply maybe age 16, and I'd get on that, because even if you get one of those 10 years later, you can get really good properties in, and we're from Southwark as well, so you can get good, really good properties there that you could then invest in, and then, you know, get at a cheaper price, and then have as a property, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then potentially have a second property as you go into other real estate and whatnot. So that's something that I regret, because I know other people that did that, and the houses that they own now in Peckham, which is basically central London that everyone wants to live in, and they're getting at such a cut price.
It's central London, guys. Did you hear
it's
that?
Central London, come on. So that's where the place to be is still. So yeah, I would have done that, and it's an indirect, you know, avenue to wealth, but I think that's something that could have been quite easily done as well, and I just missed the mark there.
Yeah, it's interesting you actually brought up the whole council flat thing. That was something that someone did mention to me when I was younger, but I don't know, it wasn't given. So I never really went for it. But also I think maybe this also has to do with my mentality a little bit as well. Like, because a part of my early childhood / growing up was in Nigeria, there was no such thing as the welfare state. So to me, when I moved here, it was just a very foreign idea to me. So even when I went through periods where I wasn't working, I didn't apply for like job seeker's allowance, and people were like, "What are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Pay your taxes, you know, when you were still working, and, you know, essentially this is your right kind of thing." So. Yeah. I feel like maybe part of the reason why some people don't go the council estate route as a way to invest in real estate is because of that mentality as well. They're just not used to the idea of like getting something from the government, quote unquote. But you're a working person, and you know you're not lazy, and you've paid your taxes. It's your right. It's actually okay.
Definitely.
As long as you don't become dependent on it, then you know, it's all good, essentially.
But, and I think culture. Sorry, I know I interrupted you, but I know culture just plays such a big impact on financial management, and we won't go into it too deep, but there's some ingrained things that we've got from our parents' generation who were just living a very different time, and very much, in some cases, was about survival, as opposed to now, where I feel like there's a baseline where we can potentially take more risks and just explore different avenues. Like I said, tech, for example, is not really something that was pushed or championed. It was be a doctor. It's the famous four, doctor, lawyer, what's the other one?
Accountant, engineer.
Literally. But a lot of it comes down to, you know, they've come to this country and, like, they want their kids to go into a profession that is going to guarantee them stable income for the rest of their career, because someone will always need a doctor or a lawyer, all of those other things. And you will always have a comfortable salary. Whereas if you're going to tech or other things that, you know, like other things that people go into now kind of thing, it's not a guarantee of income. So I understand the mentality there, but I just feel like now we're at a place where we can take more risks.
Yeah, I mean, I have to even commend you on the tech point, because that's not something I had ever heard or even thought about. And when you think about it, like, technology and the evolving of technology, I hope that is the correct grammar to use. thank you. But it's here to stay. Like, tech is actually not going anywhere. Like, it's literally going to be a part of our lives, you know. It was only, like, a few months ago I was seeing all this AI, you know, robots that pretty much have similar mannerisms to, like, human behavior. Yeah. Scary, but the point is, tech is here to stay, and you don't have to necessarily go the AI direction, but that is something to definitely look into. So I think that was a great point that you brought up about tech, because most people wouldn't even think about that at all. Okay, well, the obvious answers that you were also avoiding would be to the typical one, which is to spend less than you earn. I think that's pretty obvious. Start investing early, which you kind of mentioned when you said to start learning about the stock market a bit early on. And then the last one, which you sort of mentioned, with, like, you know, the council flats and, you know, having that as a way to earn passive income. So it's basically earning earning more, which you can do through multiple streams of income. So whether that's, you know, investing in real estate, or having, like, a side hustle, or a side business, you can multiply your income that way, as well. And for those who are interested in investing in real estate but cannot be bothered with the hassle of bad tenants, there is another way for you to invest in real estate, on the stock market. I did speak about this in season one, so go check out that episode. I spoke about real estate investment trusts. So that's something you can either check out or just do your Googles. There's lots of information out there regarding that. So moving on.
You're really blessing them, bro. You're really giving them the nuggets. So you guys, get on it ASAP.
Thank you. You know what? Yeah, I feel like this podcast is one of those ones that people will come back, like, years down the line and be like, oh my God, I wish 100. I...
literally.
But, yeah, so anyway, I hope somebody that's listening will take action, you know.
I'm going to share it with everyone, don't worry.
Oh, thank you, fam. We don't really have to do that, but I do appreciate it.
I got you.
Thank you. Okay, so moving on to my next question. What conversations, if any, did you have with family or parents about money growing up? I feel like you've sort of touched on this a little bit. Which was that we were pretty much told to save. That's what I also grew up learning. Nothing about investing, just save up your money. Which is not a bad thing, because I feel like you do have some savings as well as some investments. Were there any other conversations you sort of had?
It was mainly that, you know. It was mainly, you know, make sure you save your money. Don't spend your money, all of that. And yeah, like you said, it's definitely a positive, but I feel like you need to have a whole suite of actions to really truly build that wealth, and investing is a really big part of it. And I just did not really know much about it until my 20s. Even now, I'm still really trying to get into it. I'm not even really into it properly. But yeah, I feel like my parents did a lot of things, they just did it and didn't tell me why. Like, for example, they would just not buy me the clothes I wanted, or the wants. I never had that conversation I mentioned earlier about needs versus wants. Right. It was just, you're having this, and I just had resentment because I wasn't, it wasn't explained. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't explained, like, why we have made this decision. It's just the decision was made even until later years. So when I started working, I think I started working 16, just got a little job. I was like, you're not having money. They tried to take my money. I was like, no, all the money that you guys don't want to give me, and like you lot are trying to act like you're broke or whatever. I know you've got money and you're not explaining why you're not spending it on me or my brothers. Now I've got mine, I'm just going to spend. So I would say that's definitely somewhere that, you know, I will try and, you know, learn. And for my own kids that I have, I'll just try and have those conversations from such a young age that these are all the routes to, you know, building wealth. It's about budgeting. It's about investing. And it's about saving as well. And it's about other things. But yeah, with them, it was mainly just don't spend your money. Like, spend the minimum you can. that's not always the best route, I don't think.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with that. Whilst, you know, you should definitely, I feel like what they were trying to teach you was about this stewardship. Also, like, not being frivolous with your spending, if that makes sense. But I feel like sometimes when you're too strict on the only buy what you need, what you want, you don't really get to enjoy life. Not to be morbid or anything, but once you live here, you're not taking the money to the good. Like, you know,
it's true.
You do need to get a balance of needs and wants. I don't think it should be all in one direction, only about what you need and what you want doesn't matter. I feel like there needs to be, you know, a pretty good balance of both. But, you know, I feel like that would have given you some level of discipline with how you spend your money now. So they weren't completely wrong, but...
Absolutely not, yeah. No, it set good values. I think growing up, like, when you're more immature, I think there's a way, again, that you tailor it to younger people. And that's what I'm talking about, the school and the whole... Everything needs to come together and build up that financial literacy.
And I'm sure if they had explained it to you, I don't know, maybe you may have understood it, but then you may have also had moments where you're like, I hear you, but I still want the Air Force Ones.
literally.
Anyway, on to my next question. How do you think we can create / maintain generational wealth, in your opinion?
So, get a good accountant. But no, there's loads of ways. So things like getting life insurance is extremely important, because it just makes sure that, you know, your family is looked after you've gone. Writing a will as well, really make sure again that your assets go where you want it to go. But there's a lot of things around tax as well that people are not always necessarily aware of. In terms of inheritance tax is crazy. And also, if you transfer assets to, you know, your offspring or your beneficiaries before you pass, and I don't mean to be morbid, but death is really something that, again, we need to plan for really, really hard from a financial management perspective. But yeah, like, if you transfer assets to your kids or anything, like, I think it's 7 years before you pass, then it has an impact from a tax perspective and whatnot. So one way around that is actually buying, like, for example, if you're buying a house, you could buy it in your... so I know of people that have done that, especially in, like, other countries. The parents will buy the house, and literally the name on the agreement or whatever is their kid. So, you know, there's no one saying, oh, this is transferring when the person has passed. And these are all of the liabilities that you now have, sort of thing. So that's potentially a way around it. Putting money in a trust also helps. So yeah, that money's looked after. I think getting your pension right as well is something that's quite underrated. And again, it's something that I wish I understood earlier. Not always just... I'm still only 100%. But yeah, like, I think a lot of people just allow the firm or their company to just do the default and invest it. In fact, understanding even what a pension is and how it works, people don't always know that, you know, the money that's put aside for you is not just kept there in a bank somewhere. because it will devalue over time. So what a company will do is they'll invest it for you in different funds. And they even invest in different types of funds depending on your age. So if you're far away from retirement age, they'll invest your pension in like really big growth funds that, you know, it will really increase the value. And then as you're nearing retirement, they'll make less risky investments just so that, you know, they're not taking that risk of losing all your money so close to when you need it. But if you are clued up in, you know, the stock market and the best funds to actually invest your money in, then you could actually take charge of that yourself. You could say, no, 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 I want my money to be invested in these funds. And then literally you're generating that passive income already for when you retire, which you can then pass on to your kids when you pass or whatnot. So that's definitely something that, you know, can help build generational wealth. But there's loads of things. And again, I think that intangible thing is really important. So investing in your kids' education. Also, if you have a business, really upskill your kids in your business from early. Like, again, sorry again to mention Def, but there's a company, Albins and Sons, who have been running since the 1970s. And I remember speaking to, like, the person that was embalming one of the bodies or whatever, can't have been more than, like, he was a kid, basically. And I was thinking to myself, like, wow, you are, like, that comfortable around a dead body to be embalming it from that young age. But that's the family business. Like, that person has been groomed to do that from young. And the company turns over millions, so... You see it in school sometimes. Some kids are not serious. They're just there, like, rude and distracting or whatever. But they're comfortable because their family knows that all they need to do is just go to compulsory education till they're 16. Then they're coming to join the family business. And they're set for life. And their kids are set for life. So if you have any business, then really get your kids working on it from young and just teach them the tricks of the trade. So that can be passed on. There's more, but let me leave it there.
So. Oh yeah, there's definitely more. But honestly, you've hit all the important ones. You've hit those points. The only thing I'll just add on the pension side as well is, you know, just because your company sets aside a certain percentage from your salary towards your pension does not mean that's where it has to end. If you have a little bit of cash, you know, spare at the end of the month, you can make additional contributions as well. So. I think sometimes people also just rely on, you know, the pension fund, the percentage that's already been taken out, and they don't bother, you know, making additional contributions. So, yeah, that's something else to essentially keep in mind. So this takes us to my next question. Why do you think generational wealth is important?
It gives you more options in life, really. If you have money, then you have less worries around how you're going to pay your utilities and all sorts of things. They say money is not like, you know, money doesn't equal happiness, but money can give you peace of mind in some ways. And from a mental perspective as well, you don't want to feel like if you're to pass, you're leaving your offspring and your family with any burdens or anything like that. So yeah, I think for me, in a nutshell, I think that's really what it is. It just gives you more options in life.
I totally agree. Honestly, sometimes it's not everyday worry about money. But if you're well set up for life, then that's something you don't have to worry about. Like, you know, paying bills, you know, that's paid for, you know?
Literally, you're good.
Yeah, and just gives you access to more resources as well. So I think it's definitely something important that we need to start taking seriously, particularly in our community. So that takes me to my next question, which is how much of a role do you think racism and discrimination plays when it comes to building wealth in the Black community?
it's just got so much historical context. Dates right back to slavery. I mean, you know, black slaves weren't, they didn't own anything. They didn't own themselves. Like, even the kids that they had weren't theirs. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They were having kids to become slaves. And that context is so important because when slavery was abolished, there was hundreds of years of catching up that we needed to do. But it's not even catching up in a sense of, all right, white people are going to stand still now so that we can catch up. No, there's years of intangible benefits that they've got from that head start. And they're now in those positions of power. Like, for example, I always say a company, let's say a really big FTSE 100 company now has a CEO that is, you know, let's say it's got a CEO that's white.
Right.
And you date right back to the start of that company that was, you know, built by someone who, again, was white. Naturally, you're going to want to, when you're retiring and you're passing on to the next person, you're going to want to give it to someone that you see as another version of yourself, a younger version of yourself. So you think to yourself that, right, I've built this company, we're turning over X amount, we're doing really well, and that was under my stewardship. I don't really want difference to come in, and that's more of a risk. Do you know what I mean? So there's been years and years and years of CEOs in FTSE 100s, I assume, just passing on to people that look like them. And because that starting point, we didn't even have the chance to get into those places because we weren't even allowed to get jobs. We didn't have access to banking, loans, real estate. We just didn't have anything. We couldn't do anything, literally. It's manifested in what we see today because, again, it's just been passed down through generations. Ideologies have been passed down through generations as well. When you don't have that generational wealth as well, it means when there's things like a financial crisis, it adversely impacts people that don't have that safety net to fall upon, that money in the bank, in sitting in the savings to rely on for if there's a pandemic and, you know, we can't work. If you don't have that money there, then it's going to impact you worse than, you know, people that have got that. And also when there's times of economic opportunity as well, if you don't have any finances to rely on, then again, it's just not going to, there's an inequality there. So the historical context is so relevant for today because, again, those intangible thoughts have just been passed down and it manifests in all aspects of society.
For sure. And following on from that, actually, this links to my next question. We're almost there. The ultimate question. Obviously, you spoke about, you know, slavery and, you know, essentially the black family been ripped apart because they didn't own themselves, they didn't own their kids, instead they were owned, they were the property. So now, bringing it to 2022, in your opinion, do you think having a traditional nuclear family control to building generational wealth, or is something that people from single, you know, parent households can also, you know, attain? And then the other side of that question is, okay, we don't have a traditional family, you know, do your friendship groups, you know, or the community you have around you, is that important as well, like when it comes to building wealth? Like, what are your thoughts on those two sides of the coin, basically?
Yeah. In my opinion, I don't think the nuclear family necessarily directly impacts your likelihood of building generational wealth. Because I've said this word so much, but I think the intangible aspect of wealth is just as important as the sort of actual physical money and all of that. And, you know, you could have a single parent, and there are many people from single parent households that, you know, have gone on to build wealth and pass that on, and it's gone down through generations and whatnot. I think sort of literature and history dictates that kids from double parent, married parent households do better in school and whatnot. I just think it's very case by case. It is very case by case. You've got lots of people from that buck the trend there. But I think the community aspect is far more important. I think, you know, to build this community, this black community, we really need a lot of things to go right. So we need investment. So we need our community leaders and, you know, people that have money and whatnot to invest in the community from a financial perspective and from creating opportunities. People that have success should really look internally first, in my opinion. We can take a lot of leaves out of sort of South Asian communities and Jewish communities books, where, you know, it's us first. It's looking after our own. Black people, I would say, are at the bottom of the ladder where you know, society cares about, and no one is going to willingly want us to jump above them. So it's really about us supporting ourselves and really just resolving any differences and thinking about the bigger goal. We have to strongly oppose this BAME term, in my opinion.
Because I'm going to shake pages on my podcast. So
it has to be strongly fought, because, I mean, black people were the minority in so many communities and spaces, but we've got a very loud voice, even though we're so small. And it's like, where you shout about BAME, if a company is saying we've got 5% BAME at the moment and we want to double that to 10, but 1% of the 5 is black within your BAME, what happens is that black people will shout. The company will say, all right, fine, we'll double it to 10. But then you're doubling it in the same proportion, so it's going to 2% black and 8% whatever else is in BAME, because I don't even know at this point what the end is. But those people are benefiting from us shouting. We're such a minority. If they shouted at the VIN that we shouted, then imagine what tables they could check. And they just have completely different experiences to us. Do you know what I mean? I don't really like to talk about struggle too much. I like to focus on positive, but I just really feel like other communities really pick and choose when it suits, and for that, black people really need to look internally first, fight BAME with all its might, and just say, look, like, it's black and we're supporting ourselves first.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, you're really shaking the table. I'm just trying to recover. Like, oh wow. Fight BAME. March 31st, 10:39. I hear that.
Fight BAME.
I heard that. You know, you actually raised a lot of good points. You know, one of the things I picked up on that you said is the whole, you know, us investing in our own communities. I think that needs to go beyond Black Pound Day. I know we all love Black Pound Day when it happened. And we don't hear as much noise about Black Pound Day anymore. But I feel like when it comes to putting money back into our community, it actually needs to be a lifestyle thing. It can't just be somebody came up with this whole theme of Black Pound Day, so we've done our bit and that's it. You know, I consciously make an effort, you know, to buy from black businesses, you know, whenever I can, especially if it's a quality business. You know, I consciously make that effort. Also with that, when I'm buying from a black business, I do not try to price them down. I know us Africans especially, we've grown up in a culture where, you know, if someone tells you this is the price of something, you must pass it down. It's too expensive.
Oh, man. Honestly.
And whilst I know where that's coming from, because, you know, some people will obviously charge you prices that don't make sense, but I think we're all old enough to know when someone is giving you a price for a product or service that is a bit outrageous. You know that. But, you know, when they're actually giving you a price that makes sense, just pay the
Pay it, yeah.
Yeah, like, literally. Yeah, because I don't see how we can be saying we want to, you know, strengthen the black pound or the black dollar, or but then you're trying to price down a product or service from your own. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. Like, it just sounds like a contradiction to me. So I think that's something else that we can definitely do better on. And then in terms of, you know, the mentality side of things, you mentioned about, you know, how we can learn from, you know, the Jewish, for example. I mean, if you look at the richest men in the world, you will always find a Jewish a Jewish person there, or at least someone of Jewish descent there. That's not by accident. You know, they have some great principles that they've passed on three generations within their community. And I feel like one of the reasons why we as a black community are very behind is we have a very individualistic nature. Even though we talk about community a lot, I feel like a lot of times when people make it, that's it. Like, they just look after themselves and their family, and that's it. They don't care about nobody else. They don't look to the left. They don't look to the right. And they're just like, I've achieved my goal, and that's it. And I don't know if some of that is us still sort of going through the PTSD from, like, you know, the whole slavery and inequality thing, and where we have this, like, distrust with each other to the point where we can't look at another black person and be like, you know what, I've gotten to this position where I know I can bring another black person up. You know, I think that's something we should definitely look into. Like, why do we distrust each other? Why do we not have that desire to sort of one another? And the final thing I wanted to touch on, again, which you mentioned, was the intangibles. Those are definitely very, very important. And one thing I would recommend for people to do is watch a movie called The Banker. This ties into the first part of the question where I was asking if a traditional or nuclear family is critical to building generational wealth. Without giving, like, too much of the movie away, but one of the key things that I took from the movie was the wife of, like, one of the men, you know, one of the qualities that she had was she didn't just love and support her husband just by mouth. You know, you can be very encouraging to somebody and, you know, show them so much love. You know, he had a business that obviously was trying to get started up. But one thing she also did that I thought was very important was she made it her business to know the at least the basics. She did a bit more than the basics, but she made it her business to at least know the basics of her husband's business. You know, she made sure to have conversations about what his purpose was, what his vision was. And then she from having those conversations, she was able to see what skills she had and figure out a way that she can actually help him in action. You know, at some point she actually connected him with another guy or another man who then later on became his business partner, and they did amazing things together. So I feel like even within our choices, whether that's you know, marriage choices or friendship choices or just the people around us, I think we need to just be a bit more intentional about, you know, those kind of choices and the people that we have around us. Because I feel like that plays a great deal as well in terms of, like, your mentality and, you know, how you make decisions and how you see life and, you know, giving people encouragement or supporting them by word of mouth or, you know, however helps you support people is great. But sometimes let there be some actions, you know, behind your words. Like, what skills do you bring to the table? Anybody can encourage anyone. I can go on Google now or YouTube and watch a motivational video that might encourage me. But you need to be able to do a bit more than that. So I think that that's something else that could definitely be very useful.
It's a good point. Very good point. Don't think about that.
Yeah, because when you think about it, like, if someone has the same vision as you, or even if they don't have the same vision as you, but they believe in what you do and they genuinely love you, like, they would, you know, do their best to be there for you in a way to make sure you accomplish that goal, at least as much as within their power anyway. And if you're a decent human being, you do the same thing for them. And I feel like that's a good way for us to sort of build each other up in our community, whether that's, you know, in a marriage or in a friendship or whatever. For example, you know, years ago when I was working in events, one thing that I did was I put together like a business expo. At the time, I was working as a makeup artist. I had a friend who was doing hair. I had another one who was doing makeup. And I just brought the idea to them, like, guys, we're small businesses. How about we do this expo, put ourselves out there? And, yeah, it was very successful. You know, people were able to get their names out there. And even from doing the expo, some of the friends I did the expo with, what they were doing, it was areas that they knew that they had skills in, but they didn't realize, or they didn't think about turning it into a business. Does that make sense? From just doing that and having those conversations, you know, they were able to be like, oh, actually, I can do this as a business, and, you know, they're doing great now. So, I mean, I'm no longer in events, I've moved on to other things, but sometimes that might just be, you know, your role within a friendship, you know. Having conversations that maybe people haven't thought about before, to, you know, for them to essentially just see other ways that they can either be better as an individual, whether that's, I don't know, financially or whatever the case might be. But, you know, and they'll do the same for me as well. So if there was an area that, you know, they see that I'm not maximizing, for example, you know, they will tell me. I have this kind of friendships that are open and we're honest, with each other, and we just want to see each other win, and, you know, we're humble enough to take feedback from each other. And I just feel like we just need more of those kind of intangibles as well, because I feel like those go a long way when you're talking about building generational wealth. It's not just about the money, there are a lot of other things that need to be in place before you get to the money part. So
preach for them, preach.
That was a whole sermon, I'm joking. So yeah, my final question is, obviously we've spoken about the problems, we've spoken about some possible solutions. However, in your opinion, do you think that generational wealth is something that is actually attainable in our community? Because we're so behind that I feel like we're playing catch up, and I really want to say I see it, but it's a struggle. Do you think generational wealth is something we can definitely attain within the Black community?
Yes, but it'll take time, in my opinion. I don't know if it'll be my lifetime. Well, generational wealth is a generational thing anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think the mindset shift will happen in our generation. You made such a good point earlier about people sometimes, and I think this is especially the older generation of Black successful people, I get an impression from older people that see younger people just shining authentically, not changing who they are and still being successful. I feel a little bit of resentment sometimes from that generation, especially let's say people that are relatively successful there, from their generation. And I think that all ties to a mentality that exists in an older Black generation, of I've paid my dues, I've had to struggle. Anyone that's going to succeed has to also have gone through this struggle. Right. I've had to change who I am. I've had to not enjoy work. I've had to have people call me XYZ. And these young people think they can just come and not have it. Do you know what I mean? Like, leave the company if it's not in line with their values, or if they're not doing this or whatever. And I think, again, some of that will leave with their generation when that retires. I think we have a lot more of a positive mindset. I think I think we understand a lot more that, you know, it's not that one person, there's only space for one person up there. Like, when we're up there, we have influence and we have a say, do you know what I mean? To say that, right, I'm here. You guys have always said I want a younger version of me to join me. I'm saying I want a younger person from Peckham as well to come and be the next Sam. Do you know what I mean? Be the next Lola. Like, so I think the reason that I'm optimistic is because we definitely have skills. We definitely have competencies. We have networks and we have wealth in our community. We have all of those things. And we just need to adapt our mentality to say charity actually begins at home. So we actually just need to use all of those four things to better ourselves. Like you said, it needs to go beyond Black Pound Day. It needs to go into, you know, building our businesses. You look at things like Google, Facebook, all of those things, like, those are obviously giants, but they were actually, one day they were actually just one guy with an idea. Like, do you know what I mean? Some neek that was there with an idea that no one was really, really trying to back. So we need to really see our businesses as our gateway to where we can, you know, expand in the future. Like, venture capital money, I read somewhere that there was, that out of all venture capital funds, only 1% goes to Black founders. So our entrepreneurs can't even get access to those networks to grow our potential Googles. So we need to really push for that change. And then once we get that money, we need to grow our businesses and create jobs for our people, keep everything in-house as much as, but obviously it's important to have allies and, like, and, you know, the network as well of non-Black people, but we really do need to prioritize ourselves and build our own communities. We look at other communities, they have a common shared goal. I don't know what it is in the Jewish community, I don't know what it is in the Muslim community, but I know that there are a lot more aligned in their thinking than Black people. So I don't know if it's, we need a leader that everyone rates or a thing that everyone can at least get behind. But yeah, we need to really find what our niche is and just like be the experts in that. So what do Black people really love doing? We like partying. All right, cool. Let's own all of the partying ticket like space, that market. Do you know what I mean? Let's find a market and bring tech into it as well and really just make sure we own that. Like, we're the people that people go to for knowledge, that other people can benefit from our knowledge, and just keep like passing on that knowledge to the next generation, giving them a bigger platform to innovate. And yeah, like, I'll be watching from heaven when
from heaven. Okay. I am done with you.
But it'll take a long time, but yeah, like, it can happen still.
I believe you. Definitely given me some hope, because sometimes I get tired. Honestly, I'm not gonna lie to you. I just get tired, because it's like, conversations are great, but how many people are actually acting on these conversations that we're having, that we're bringing to the table? So I'm hoping that when people sort of listen to today's podcast, they'll feel inspired and motivated to actually do something about it. But yeah, guys, check out the movie The Banker. Like, it really ties into a lot of the things Sam has also just said. So definitely check that out. And thank you, Sam, for joining me today.
Lola, thank you so much for inviting me. I've had a brilliant time. And again, I honestly mean it. This is an amazing platform. Like, what you're doing is so important. We need more of you. Do you know what I mean? Because this is an intangible that people can really, really benefit from. So yeah, I'm going to share it, and thanks again for inviting
me. Thank you. You've come up with a lot of interesting points and ideas that I feel like people can definitely benefit from. So we definitely need more of you too, Sam. So don't just leave me out here in the field to do all the work. But yeah, thanks again for joining me. Where can the people find you?
Me, LinkedIn. I don't really know the audiences of this, but anyway, I'm not private with any of my stuff. So LinkedIn, I'm Samuel Aluko, last name A-L-U-K-O. And Instagram, Sam_Aluko. So you can find me there as well.
Thanks again, guys, for listening. Please like, comment, share, follow, subscribe, all that good stuff. And I'll see you soon on the next episode.
Take it easy, guys. Bye.